What happens when what we do conflicts with who we are?
I got an email that said, basically, thank you for your services. They're no longer required. We will not be renewing your contract. And then the thing that really pissed me off was a link to a suicide hotline. I got a positive teaching review. I had really, really good student reviews. At no point were any complaints or issues brought to me about the courses I was teaching. The only thing that changed was that I came out as trans.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Malawi's Constitutional Court upholds anti-queer sex laws, Japanese court grants first legal gender change without surgery, and exploring the perils of working while queer. Those stories and more this week now that you've found This Way Out.
I'm Marcos Najera.
And I'm Wendy Natividad.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 13th, 2024. A Malawi constitutional court is upholding the criminalization of same-gender relationships. Gay Dutch citizen Jan Willem Axter and transgender Malawian Jana Gonani lost their challenges to those laws in a June 28th decision. Axter and Gonani are being charged in separate cases. Axter faces 9 counts of violating the anti-queer sexual abuse and sodomy laws. Gonani is legally viewed as a homosexual man and is charged with so-called unnatural offenses. Both plaintiffs argue that the laws punishing carnal knowledge against the order of nature and gross indecency violate their rights to privacy and dignity under the country's constitution and international human rights laws. It took the 3-judge panel 6 hours of deliberation to conclude that the carnal knowledge prohibitions do not specifically discriminate against homosexual individuals. The court said that the plaintiffs could seek relief in parliament by asking lawmakers to amend the country's anti-queer sex laws. Meanwhile, the criminal prosecutions against Axter and Gonani can continue. Violations of the law carry a prison sentence of up to 14 years. National and international human rights groups roundly condemned the ruling. In the words of Amnesty International's Kanyo Farizi, the court's decision to keep these discriminatory laws on the books is a bitter setback for human rights in Malawi. The ruling manifestly flies in the face of Malawi's constitution, the African Charter, and international human rights law, which all clearly prohibit discrimination. Farisi says the ruling makes Malawi an outlier among Southern African nations, where same-sex sexual conduct has largely been decriminalized.
Aruba and Curaçao must immediately allow same-gender couples to marry. This by order of the Dutch Supreme Court. The Caribbean islands are 2 of 3 constituent countries of the Netherlands, where the first legal queer weddings in the world were held on April 1, 2001. Courts with jurisdiction over the islands ruled for marriage equality in 2022, but lawmakers have refused to follow through. Aruba's parliament actually voted down a marriage equality bill in June. Out-gay Dutch Senator Boris Dittrich celebrated the July 12th ruling, saying, "The Supreme Court took into consideration that politicians had been debating this issue for a long time, but without results." In addition to Aruba and Curaçao, Sint Maarten is also a Caribbean constituent country within the Netherlands. It may also be covered by the ruling, although it was not part of the court case that decided it. The Dutch overseas municipalities Bonaire, Saba, and Sint Eustatius have enjoyed marriage equality since 2012. Gay Aruban Senator Miguel Mansour calls it an amazing victory. He told the Washington Blade, "Aruba progresses into a society with less discrimination, more tolerance, and acceptance."
Britain's Labour Party swept to victory in national elections on July 4th, ending the Conservative Party's 14-year grip on government rule. While progressives around the world in general breathed a sigh of relief, cautiously optimistic might be overstating LGBTQ activists' view of what's to come under the new government. Incoming Prime Minister Keir Starmer campaigned on a promise to improve the rights and safety of LGBTQ people by banning conversion therapy and expanding hate crime laws. At the same time, Labour seems to be bent on targeting trans people, just like the outgoing Tory government. Starmer himself has backtracked on his previous affirmation that transgender women are women. He now believes that trans people should use sex-segregated public bathrooms and changing rooms based only on their birth certificate gender. Starmer's new health secretary will be MP Wes Streeting, who's a former Stonewall activist. However, in line with Starmer's position, he has said trans women should be barred from single-sex hospital wards. Streeting not only supports the Tory government's temporary ban on reversible puberty blockers and hormone therapy for trans people under the age of 18, he wants to make the ban permanent.
French voters handed the burgeoning far-right and blatantly anti-queer National Rally Party a humiliating defeat in national elections on July 5th. Pundits were confounded after the stunning wins their candidates posted in the first round of voting. However, that drove center and leftist parties to form an amazing coalition in only 2 weeks. In the second round of voting, the National Rally Party came in third. The left-wing parties control the most seats in parliament, and President Emmanuel Macron's second-place centrist Renaissance Party continues to hold the balance of power. Macron had called the snap elections in June after the National Rally Party shockingly won the most seats in the European Parliament elections. LGBTQ issues were rarely raised during the campaign. When they did, Macron spoke out against some rights for transgender people. The National Rally Party vowed to restrict access to IVF and surrogacy services for same-gender couples. They would even consider repealing marriage equality.
A transgender woman in Japan will be allowed to change her legal gender without having to undergo gender reassignment surgery. And it's a first. The anonymous woman in her late 40s says that having to undergo the surgery would present major financial burdens and that certain health conditions would make surgery risky for her. Lower courts still denied her request. The Hiroshima High Court overturned the lower court decisions on July 10th. It found that 20-year-old laws in Japan making surgery a prerequisite for legal gender change may be an unconstitutional infringement of equal protection guarantees. The court determined that the hormone therapy the trans woman plaintiff has undergone sufficiently feminized her body. Japan's Supreme Court decided in October of last year to remove the additional requirement that the surgery include sterilization. The Japan Alliance for LGBT Legislation praised the ruling. Its statement said in part, "It can open the door for transgender females to be able to legally change their gender without undergoing surgery." However, the organization remains concerned because the decision does not affect trans people whose medical condition might prevent them from taking hormones.
Finally, a Missouri judge says there's no reason for blind obedience to the Attorney General's civil investigative demands when the privacy rights of transgender young people and their families are at stake. Judge Joseph White of the St. Louis Circuit Court rebuffed efforts by Missouri's Republican Attorney General Andrew Bailey to fully access the medical records of children from the Washington University Transgender Center at St. Louis Children's Hospital and three similar facilities. Bailey launched a so-called investigation of potential child abuse in pediatric gender-affirming healthcare in March of 2023. The facilities challenged Bailey's order while providing his office with redacted information. Bailey then demanded unredacted versions under the Missouri Merchandising Practices Act. According to Judge White's July 12th ruling, the AG simply has no right to private information beyond the redacted versions. He noted that the act specifically exempts privileged material. Bailey says he'll appeal White's decision.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending July 13th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazor, with technical assistance by Daniel Huesillas, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Marcos Najera. Stay healthy.
And I'm Wendy Natividad. Stay safe.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
I'm Margaret Cho.
I'm John Ritchie.
This is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Clinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
I'm Clive Barker.
This is Judy Shepard.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
I'm Jerry Jewell.
I'm Stephen Fry.
I'm Harvey Milk.
Hi, this is Janice Ian.
My name's Robbie Rogers.
This is Essex Hemphill.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
I'm Tab Hunter.
I'm Billy Bean.
This is John Cameron Mitchell.
Hello, I'm Bruce Valange.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson.
I'm Reverend Troy Perry.
I'm Robbie Kaplan.
I'm Andrew Sullivan.
This is Augustine Burroughs.
I'm Barney Frank.
I'm Cleve Jones.
My name is Kate Kendall.
I'm Dan Savage.
I'm B.D. Wong.
This is Dorothy Ellis.
I'm Patricia Nell Warren.
I'm Amanda Burst.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, and you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The showpiece of the homosexual movement.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How dare they?
And those who love them.
You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
Oh, my.
And that's the truth.
Please do stay tuned.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Is work working for LGBTQ people in the U.S.? Disturbing trends are evident in recent industry studies and in the personal testimonies of queer employees who come out and stay out on the job. This Way Out's David Hunt has been looking into how employers are apparently backtracking on their support for ensuring welcoming workplaces. His two-part feature investigates the pitfalls of working while queer.
For many of us, what we do for a living occupies a big part of our day and consumes a large measure of our physical and emotional energy. But what happens when what we do conflicts with who we are? I'm David Hunt. This week, in the first part of a two-part series, I'll look at some of the pitfalls of working while queer, and why many employers are doing less to support diversity and inclusion in the workplace. Let's get to work. Coming out at work has always been risky. Back in 1967, Richard Mitch joined a gay rights group protesting police raids on gay bars in Los Angeles. He helped start the group's newsletter, which you can still read today. It's now a magazine called The Advocate. But you never saw Mitch's name in the masthead or in a byline. He used a pseudonym, Dick Michaels, so his employers at the American Chemical Society wouldn't find out he was gay. In the pre-Stonewall era, coming out at work wasn't the norm. In fact, you were likely to lose your job. Fast forward three decades to the mid-1990s, and the workplace was definitely more welcoming for LGBTQ people, especially in big cities like London, New York, and Seattle. U.S. Congressional Representative Barney Frank, who had spent the 1980s trying to keep his sexual orientation under wraps, set the record straight, so to speak, in a 1995 anthology titled Out in the Workplace: The Pleasures and Perils of Coming Out at Work. The personal consequences of my public coming out, he wrote, have been extraordinarily favorable. Many LGBTQ people who were out at work in those days, including myself, would largely agree. Fast forward another three decades to today. With more of us out at work than ever before, how are we faring? Well, it's complicated. In this program, I'll talk with a trans college professor about her experiences coming out on campus and find out why she's leaving the university with more questions than answers. And I'll try to answer the question of why so many employers are backtracking on their support for workplace equality. But first, let's look at some data. The online company EduBirdie recently surveyed 2,000 people worldwide who identify as members of the LGBTQ+ community. They found that 63% have faced discrimination in their careers, and 70% feel lonely, misunderstood, marginalized, and excluded at work. Nearly half, 44%, say they quit a job due to a lack of acceptance, and 45% say they've been passed over for promotions. The numbers seem disappointing, if a bit abstract, but when you look behind the data and talk to people facing real-life issues on the job, things get personal and, as I said, complicated.
They say when a girl walks the edges of the world, she'll find herself if she looks for long enough.
My name is Cora Martell. I am an erstwhile academic.
Erstwhile is the word someone with two PhDs uses to mean they used to be a lecturer in the Religious Studies Department at the University of Tennessee. That changed on May 15th.
I got an email that said, "Dear Dr. Martell, basically, thank you for your services. They're no longer required. We will not be renewing your contract." And then the thing that really pissed me off was a link to a suicide hotline. And that was it.
That wasn't the only life-changing email exchanged between Martell and the university in the spring semester. On April 5th, Martell wrote to her colleagues in the Religious Studies Department to announce what she called a small personal update. Martell, who had identified as queer and non-binary for a decade, got right to the point.
I sort of had a realization that I was probably trans or trans feminine in some way, the specifics of which I will just say I'm still working out. I sent out an email and I simply announced it.
Is there a connection between Martell's decision to come out as trans and the university's decision 6 weeks later to hire someone else to teach her religious studies courses? That's the complicated part. Because everyone in Martell's department seemed really supportive of her decision to come out.
Some of the older, more senior faculty are either identify as lesbian or queer, and they were just overwhelmingly helpful. They helped me change my name information in the system. They gave me resources at UT, all of the stuff that you'd want. I had no sense that this was going to be a problem.
If Martell's new gender expression wasn't the problem, maybe her work as a teacher fell short. Doesn't seem like it.
The thing that's bothering me about the story is that I got a positive teaching review from a colleague, right? Every year we get observed. I had an annual performance review in which the chair explained to me I had really, really good student reviews. At no point were any complaints or issues brought to me about the courses I was teaching. The only thing that changed between my very positive performance review that I signed and the dean signed saying I was doing an adequate job and my being non-renewed was that I came out as trans.
The University of Tennessee doesn't have to give a reason when they don't renew a teaching contract, but that doesn't mean there isn't a reason. Martell tried to find out by talking with her supervisor and her colleagues. She hit a brick wall.
Nobody in my department was informed. The only person that knew about this decision was the chair. The assistant chair was not informed. None of the senior faculty were informed. None of the non-tenure track faculty were informed. Nobody was apparently consulted. And all I ever got was that there were conversations, apparently, though no one will tell me with whom or what they were. And quote, "the decision has been made."
The loss of her teaching position has left Martell struggling, emotionally as well as financially. Her paycheck has been the primary source of income in a household that includes her partner Margot and their toddler son, Ollie. Now, as Martell looks for work in and around Knoxville, she's relying on the generosity of friends and family members, as well as a fundraising campaign on GoFundMe.com.
I'm not doing well. That's something I will share. I am very much a compromised person emotionally, mentally right now. I'm barely holding it together. I wish someone had just come to me and been like, we don't like you because of your identity, because then I would know. Then I would know, but then also like it would be a violation of, you know, federal law. So they would get in trouble. But the not knowing is maddening. It is taking a toll on my mental health.
I asked the media relations department at UT Knoxville whether Martel's transition had anything to do with the decision to not renew her contract. They haven't responded. You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my look at the perils of coming out in the workplace. University professor Cora Martel questions the way she was treated after coming out as trans on campus. To be clear, she isn't accusing the university of bias. She just wants some honest answers.
I'm not particularly accusing anyone of anything. I'm actually just too tired to even do that at this point. I'm just trying to figure out how to have a meaningful and good life, and it's turning out to be a little complicated.
It's possible that Martel's transition just comes at a challenging time for a public university, especially one in the conservative southern United States. The University of Tennessee isn't exactly a pioneer when it comes to offering protections for LGBTQ faculty, staff, and students. The school's Pride Center, established in 2010, closed down briefly in 2016 after the state legislature defunded the Office of Diversity and Inclusion. Funding was restored, but the office remains a favorite target of conservatives, who criticize it for promoting anti-racist conferences and other social justice efforts. The university dropped the words diversity and inclusion from the division's name in 2023, renaming it Access and Engagement. And it's not just the University of Tennessee that's reassessing the value of DEI, the most common acronym for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. A survey of global DEI efforts, released in January 2024 by CultureAmp, an employee analytics platform, found that support for such programs has tanked. The percentage of companies doing more than the bare minimum required by law to protect their employees from discrimination dropped from 71% to 60% over the last 2 years. And the percentage of companies with a dedicated DEI leader dropped from 56% to 41%. In fact, companies have shied away from even talking about diversity and inclusion. The percentage of companies holding DEI-related discussions fell by 20 percentage points over the last 2 years. And the percentage with a strategic plan to improve diversity declined by 13 percentage points. According to the survey, which collected data from 175,000 employees at nearly 400 companies worldwide, employees see what's happening, and they're not happy, depending on who you ask. While 82% of straight white men say their employers give everyone an equal opportunity to succeed, only 69% of LGBTQ women feel the same way. Why has there been such a dramatic drop in support for a welcoming workplace? The study's authors say DEI has become both a buzzword and the target of significant backlash, whether due to political pressure or disillusionment over investments that haven't turned into results. Many organizations are backing away from their commitments to building workplaces that work for everyone. What can LGBTQ people do to fight this trend? I'll take up that topic next week in the second part of this series on the perils of coming out on the job. Next week, I'll introduce you to a longtime trans activist who has learned that the promises employers make to LGBTQ employees don't always match reality, and how she's worked to bridge the gap.
You know, I felt like I was walking off a cliff. The cliff could be 1 inch or it could be 1,000 feet. I just didn't know what was going to be on the other side of that.
And I'll ask a queer psychologist what tools we all need to navigate the pitfalls of a hostile work environment in 2024.
A lot of the politics at work are about being well-liked by your supervisors, by your colleagues. And so for LGBTQ people, you're having to do this calculus in your mind of, will disclosing, sharing my identity, will bringing attention to discrimination I'm facing jeopardize how well-liked I am at this workplace and possibly future promotions, raises, or job security for me?
I'd like to thank Professor Cora Martell for sharing her story this week. Until next week, for This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
This Way Out historic broadcasts from 1988 to 2023 are now preserved and available for research and streaming at the American Archive of Public Broadcasting and at the University of California Santa Barbara Libraries Special Collections.
Welcome to the inaugural broadcast of Inside Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
The early programs were titled Inside Out until an organization of the same name sent a cease and desist letter.
I'm Greg Gordon.
I'm Lucia Chappelle. And during the next half hour, you'll hear reports on the United Kingdom's notoriously homophobic Clause 29.
Almost 200 lesbian and gay activists gather for a war conference in the United States.
In the Magic Kingdom, only heterosexuals can dance cheek to cheek.
And despite violence last September, lesbians and gays in Dubuque prepare for another march. And maybe you can help.
All that and even more now that you're tuning Inside Out.
This Way Out Preservation and Access Project was made possible by grants from UC Santa Barbara Libraries and the American Archive of Public Broadcasting, a collaboration between the Library of Congress and GBH. We thank Keith Brown and Ira Ruffles at Gay Spirit Radio and David Soibert at UC Santa Barbara for the loan of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes for digitization. Digitization done by George Blood Audio in Philadelphia. I'm Brian DeShazer for This Way Out.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Marcos Najera and Wendy Natividad and produced by Brian DeShazer with technical assistance by Daniel Wisius. Our feature correspondent was David Hunt. You heard music by Yes from Laurel and Hardy Movies, by Huey Lewis in the News, Hotham, Josique, Josh Furmeister, Avs, and Sam Cooke. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Steve Sims of Seattle, Washington, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WBSU Brockport, New York, KPOV Bend, Oregon, BridgeRadioPA.com Perth Andover, New Brunswick, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.